Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. This week is a fascinating discussion with Stuart Grice, one of the founding members of Fitness Genes. We cover how genes might affect your health, your propensity for different sports, your behaviour, and even your eating habits.
To summarise, yes, there is a huge component of genetics to obesity, but it's an interaction between our current environment, which is highly obesogenic, processed food, and the fact that we have genetics that have evolved when starvation was a big problem.
Yeah. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. Stuart Grice is one of the founders of Fitness Genes, and that's a company that will test your genes. And my first questions to him really were, what made you want to start the company, and what is your background that got you into this world?
Sure, no, thanks for the invitation. So I was an academic for 10 years. I worked on neuromuscular disease and neurodegeneration. So what I did, my day-to-day job was mutate genes in models, so cell models, animal models, and see how, when changing those genes, you can lead to
not computer models
or fashion models.
Yourself.
So actually, interestingly, within our department, there was individuals that did the computer modeling. What we did in vivo models, where I actually used a fruit fly. So a little tiny. So when you put your beer out in summer, and these little flies fly around your beer. What we do is all those flies contain genes that can form muscles, that can form neurons. We can mutate those genes and then study what happens to the fly. Do they get weaker? Look at the neurons specifically in that muscle. What happens to the neurons? We can then feed drugs to them and see if we can enable them to recover. So actually you use this as a model to understand the biology of disease. So of course,
fruit flies are great for that because their life cycle is like 6 hours or something, isn't it?
It's yeah. So 11 days. From larvae to adult fly, if you keep them at 25 degrees and all the gubbins that's now coming back to me. So but what we're doing is understanding how genetic changes can lead to the generation of the nervous system. And of course, that then leads on to the clinical questions of how do we then solve these problems? And at the same time of me looking at how genes impact individuals, we're also thinking about how then we can start to maintain a better nervous system. How can we protect neurons? And then I started to read a lot about sort of exercise, nutrition, as well as the clinical components about drugs. You start to see that we were in the lab changing. We're interested in calorie restriction. How does calorie restriction impact some of our models? I also worked on neurodegeneration in terms of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's as well. So I had this general interest in neurodegeneration, which is a very significant health burden to the globe. But then also you start to think about, you know, personally and looking at your family and looking at how you solve the problems of neurodegeneration. So at the same time, we had a couple of other co-founders, one who's a clinician who's really interested in health and fitness. He was a medic, but also run gyms. So he kind of had very much the translational component. And we had Sam, who's the current CEO, who's another co-founder, and she was involved in technology transfer. So worked with universities that then rolled out companies from the knowledge that's built within the university. So we had myself, who was kind of the hardcore scientist, Sam, who was the translational scientist. So she has a PhD in genetics, but was working with how do you take a company or the ideas out of a university or out of a group of individuals and then build a business out of it. And then we had the other co-founder, Dr. Dan Reardon, who was basically working in gyms and helping people get healthier and was dealing with, he was in A&E as well at the time, he was dealing with the blunt end of what is the health crisis that we generally see ourselves in the Western world at the minute. So those three sets of ideas helped found what is now Fitness Genes.
So you got all bases covered, really,
in the
brains starting this thing.
Yes.
So Fitness Genes is a testing company, really. What are your tests for?
Cool. So let's step back a little bit. So let's think about genes. You know, we're sitting talking today. We may be digesting our lunch. We're looking at each other. We're thinking things. All these processes are governed by proteins that are encoded by genes in our body. So they're controlling our behaviors, our activities, our metabolic function, everything else. We look at a panel of between 600 and 700,000 genetic variants that alter the way these proteins can be produced or act within the body. So ultimately, what creates genetic diversity between different individuals? So we test these genes. We also take non-genetic data. So this is lifestyle data. So it's not just about your genetics. We have the genetics of our environment and also the trajectory of aging over time. And these three components create the diversity we see in different people. So that diversity can be sporting prowess in a way. It could be disease risk. It could be behavioral changes. So we then model all this. We've got a patent actually on the process that how we do this modeling using the data, the genetic and non-genetic data. We then produce a number of what we call traits that cover the main areas of health. So we've got sort of sport and fitness, which is hypertrophy, maintaining and building muscle, endurance performance, and then the cardiovascular health, the metabolic health. So this kind of doffs its cap to diabetes and metabolic syndrome, and then cognitive health, which looks at processes associated with dementia.
Okay. So you test for these things. What do you test on? You know, is it a home test? If I take your test, what do I get? Do I get sort of a vial that I have to prick my thumb and put some blood in and do it at home, or how does it work?
Sure. So I guess, yeah, the sort of the general sort of idea of testing is blood testing. So the one great thing about DNA is generally it doesn't change. And in every cell of your body, you have the same genetic code. Generally, you can have these somatic mutations that happen over time, but in a nutshell, we'll consider that they change. That means you can get it from anywhere. So you probably remember a few years ago where we were going through the COVID epidemic. Actually, you've got lots of cells in your body. And remember swabbing and everything else. You can get stuff from your mouth. Actually, we have something that's a lot less invasive than the swabbing. And
I'm glad about that, because I remember sticking a thing up your nose was really quite unpleasant.
Yeah, no, and especially if you're doing properly. So we have, it's just a spit kit. So what you do is you don't eat for a couple of hours because that can alter the results, but you spit into a tube. It goes straight into a buffer, which contains, I think, alcohol and a few other bits, that then preserves your DNA. So literally you can spit into a tube at home. We can post this to you. You close it up. You put it in the post. DNA is amazingly stable at room temperature. So, you know, we've done some tests and we've had DNA that's lasted for 4 or 5 years. That you can still get a signal from. So you post it to us, we send it to a lab. So the lab then analyzes these 600,000 to 700,000 genetic variants. We get this back in raw data. Then we we've been around for 13 years nearly now. So we've been building these genetic models that look at particular variants that have been the most researched variants that have been associated with different health variations or. And then we build these, we analyze them, we then create a number of traits, and then you can log onto your website and can look at the different traits you have. And some of this can be associated with muscle function, but some also cardiovascular health issues, how you process vitamins, lots of different things associated with it. So it's a holistic view of health, even though, as our name suggests, fitness genes, we very much started from the fitness industry because we thought that was the first one of the biggest factors associated with mitigating chronic disease. We've broadened out now to looking more holistically at health.
Okay, so it's health in general. Yeah. One of the things that I'd like to ask about there, which may or may not show my complete misunderstanding of the whole thing, but I'll ask anyway. So you're saying you're looking at, you know, 600 or 700,000 different genes and how they combine and how they work. So that kind of means, I'm thinking that you don't get one or two genes that means that you're going to be a fantastic sprinter. You get a whole kind of selection that means there's a reasonable chance that actually you might be quite a good runner. If nothing's terribly clear cut. Am I correct there?
It depends on the person. So with running, I think that's a great example where the scoring is polygenic. That means lots of genetic variants are associated with increased or decreased propensity. So if you have an increased burden or increased collection of lots of variants associated with power, strength, for example, you are more likely to be powerful. But however, you can think about, but there are some genes do have large effects. So one example is alpha-actinin 3. So this is a protein that sits on the Z disc in your muscle. So our muscles have these contractile units that enable us to lift things and everything else. And in our population, because again, you look at different populations, you can have different percentages of the variants. 21% of people have a mutation and that they've inherited from their mother and father. So both chromosomes have this mutation. That means they don't produce this protein. So what does this mean? Well, if you have the protein, well, it enables higher velocity with muscle contractions. It basically moves you towards an anaerobic state. But if you don't have the protein, you actually move towards an aerobic state. So it gives you better fatigue resistance. It basically switches more to oxidative metabolism that's associated with endurance athletes and slows fatigue associated with endurance athletics. But when you've got the protein, actually, when you're doing resistance exercise, so lifting weights, actually you recover quicker. So it actually protects it. Now, this protein also has been shown that if you have the protein, it actually reduces some of the impacts around neurodegenerative disease and neuromuscular disease, so more neuromuscular disease in particular. Also, if you don't have the variant, which has been shown to protect muscle structure and recovery, you actually increases your risk of sarcopenia, so muscle wasting when you're older. So yes, our biology is very much associated with many, many variants, but there are these variants that can have big impacts on people. And a good example is if you have the mutation in cystic fibrosis, a transmembrane regulator, that you have cystic fibrosis. That is an incredibly significant mutation that will have a huge impact on your life. For a lot of people that don't have these genetic variants or mutations associated with disease, you're more likely to be having to combine lots of genetic variant data points to then start to predict what their propensities or risks are in the future.
Okay, let's just rewind a little bit. You mentioned there was sort of one particular gene that would govern whether you'd be good at sort of long distance running if you had it, and then if you didn't have it, you're more likely to be better at sort of power type things. If I got it that way round, and then you mentioned sarcopenia, which is, you know, losing muscle mass as you get older. Mm-hmm. Now, that strikes me, that could be quite a very useful thing to know. And the way you explained it is, it's like, actually, that's fairly definite. We can tell you if you're likely to get sarcopenia, loss of muscle mass, when you get older. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, but yeah, it's and again, some of the traits we look at are, you know, you may be two times more likely or three times more likely to get sarcopenia, but there are other traits we look at that you're 10, 15 times more likely to get dementia, or you're very significantly likely to get hypercholesterolemia, which leads to atherosclerosis that then causes heart disease. So again, not all variants are made equal. So there's some which are, we would call critical. If you have these particular variants, we would suggest you look at these first. And then for some people that are fortunate to not have these significant variants, go, okay, well, let's look at the combined data and think about, okay, how would we sort of navigate your current situation, what we think your health priorities are. And this again can be around, you know, managing blood sugar, building muscle, losing weight, you know, obviously something people are very interested in. And other cardiovascular and cognitive processes.
Yeah, because I mean, some of these things, just going back to the sarcopenia one, because that's one that I can kind of envisage and sort of understand, because it's relatively simple. You know, if you've got an idea that you might suffer from that when you're older, you can think, all right, maybe I should start to do something about that now, tomorrow, this afternoon.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think this is the one thing we always got challenged on at the beginning was, oh, this is going to be, you know, it's going to be deterministic. People are just going to give up. We actually found the information is quite empowering. It actually, because we have this in this world of health, and you do this this radio station podcast, you will see all these different ideas within health. To the health consumer, it's so confusing. There's so many ideas and conditions you may get. So actually having some data that goes, well, actually, these are the things I need to focus on, I think is really important. So because the glib reaction to that would always be, oh, yeah, well, everyone should be doing resistance exercise, you know, or everyone should be improving their VO2 max, or everyone should be doing yoga, or everyone should be eating vegetables, or everyone should be eating meat. And actually having this knowledge about yourself enables you to go, okay, well, that's the marketplace of health ideas, but what really is important for me? So having a knowledge of actually your risk really, yeah, as you said, enables you to target what to do next.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Before we continue with the show, I just want to remind you about the book that's written using the knowledge from many past guests on the Relax Back UK show, and also gets the reader to ask questions about their own health. It's called Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health, and it's available on Amazon.
The other side of things, if a regular guy, me, I'm a regular guy, would, you know, would to take this test and really doesn't have an awful lot of knowledge about this sort of stuff, and then gets an absolute massive kind of report back with information on 600,000 or 700,000 genes. I mean, I'm sure it's presented in a way that's a little more understandable, but even so, this could scare the hell out of people, couldn't it?
Yeah, and we sort of, well, one thing's first, we don't deal with the congenital diseases. You know, the cystic fibrosis, the spinal muscular atrophy, the Huntington's disease, they're things that are tackled on the clinical level. But still, you're absolutely right. We look at information that is linked to health risks. So we've kind of modified the product over time. So we actually have a direct-to-consumer product, which you're describing right now, where they look at all the different traits and they have different health sort of risks associated with them. First thing, sir, you can get in contact. We have a team of scientists, clinicians. We have people very often contact us. Interestingly, we find in people are more interested in digging down into the risk than being too scared of it. The second point, there are people out there who will be frightened. We've created a second part of our business now where we actually go through practitioners. And I think healthcare in generally, it has to be collaborative. You know, you need nutritional support, you need exercise support, you need diagnostic support. The preventative space in the UK, at least, and I know you have listeners worldwide, and I think more globally, the preventative space has been ignored by the health sector, because they're obviously dealing with cancer, they're dealing with dementia, they're dealing with all the, you know, accidents and emergency, cardiovascular disease, they're dealing with all those sort of really primary acute problems. Prevention is. So what we've done now is what we've
prevention
created
is better than cure.
Well, exactly. Now that's it. But we're also aware that you're absolutely right. There is, you know, biology is complicated as well. You know, there are trade-offs in biology. It's not like you have good genes and bad genes. There's actually many trade-offs. So what we've done now, we've built a platform where practitioners, so these can be personal trainers. So if you're a personal trainer, you can use our service. It can be nutritionists, it can be clinicians, that take our data and then they can use it to better inform their decisions. And of course, generally at the moment, this is in the private sector, not within the public sector. We've talked to many NHS groups at the moment. This is very difficult to get through the noise in that sector at the moment. So we are, one, giving the ability for practitioners who have more knowledge than the average person on the street to use our language. And two, we're producing training programs. So we've just, for personal trainers, we've released our first SimSpa accredited training program to educate the individuals about what genetics is. The questions you've been asking now, you know, are they big impact or small impact? How do I navigate this combinations of risks? So these people can, and I think this is not a fitness genes problem, this is a healthcare problem where we need to educate the practitioners to understand this data. But this data, genetic data, epigenetic data, gut microbiome data, blood data is not going away. We just need better ways of and people educated to be able to use the information to get the best out for the people looking at prevention.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that actually, because what you talk about practitioners, you know, I must admit, I would be much happier talking to my GP with this report on my genes than a fitness trainer. Now, maybe that's just because I'm a snob, or actually, you know, they're different sorts of people. And my GP can call himself a doctor, and he gets in big trouble if he's actually not a doctor. Anyone can call themselves a personal trainer.
And this is really so for example, what the personal trainer does, it helps. So we've talked about sarcopenia, we've talked about building muscle, we've talked about sport. For the personal trainer, they're not going to be recommending what nutrition's going to reduce hypercholesterolemia. They're going to help you build a training program that will enable you to build muscle to mitigate. So like muscle mitigates insulin resistance, muscle mitigates, strong muscle, exercise muscle, you know, metabolic syndrome, you know, frailty later in life. So what they're doing is taking that component of our product and translating it. However, a personal trainer cannot advise on nutrition. So then a component of the product will then go via a nutritionist. And eventually we envisage it then going. So we're talking to big private healthcare groups that have clinicians, and we're working with them at the moment. So how we translate that through a doctor and a GP. So you're absolutely right. It's that the information will be used by different practitioners on the chain of experts within the health marketplace.
I was going to say you have a process of vetting these practitioners.
And don't go to your GP, and no disrespect to general practitioners, but they admit this themselves, that they have a week's nutritional training at medical school. Don't go to your GP for nutritional advice. And actually, a lot of the, because again, so let's look at, I think this is a good example, actually. So one of the traits we look at is it's quite rare. So you're looking at about one in 500 people maybe carrying one of these variants, and it's something called familial hypercholesterolemia. So you have a mutation either in a receptor or protein that associates with that receptor that enables you to uptake from the bloodstream LDL. So LDL is this lipoprotein that is associated with many other components with increased atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease. The NHS has recognized that this mutation is incredibly important. It's been proven to massively increase the risk of heart attack. And I think it's 50% of men with one of these mutations, if they haven't had a trajectory of medical intervention, will have a heart attack by the age of 50. So the NHS have recognized this. You can go down their reports. And the reason they don't do the testing is because they don't have the individuals within the health service to deal with the consequences. It's not because the genetic variant isn't important. It's the fact there's just not the infrastructure. So again, this is
in the long term, that will probably save the NHS some money, because they're preventing a heart attack rather than dealing with a heart attack.
Yeah, exactly. So for things like statins and PCSK9 inhibitors, in reality, there are people in their 30s that should be taking them if they have this genetic variant. I know statins are quite a divisive subject, and it's really important for some people to take them, and some other people won't get much of a benefit. And again, you can see it with the whole COVID vaccine and everything else, where the narrative around health has become incredibly divisive. But it's actually because personalization doesn't exist. We still work on populations of going, well, give everyone a statin and 10% of those people will benefit from it. Some people may get adverse reactions, but on the account of doing that, it will reduce deaths and it will reduce cost to the NHS. However, we've kind of ignored the people that may have adverse effects, and it's the same, and the same philosophy was given with the COVID vaccine, that add all the numbers up, it had a positive benefit, but some people died taking it as well. And it's genetics can start to help people understand how you start triaging and partitioning people and treating different, the conditions in different ways. So hypercholesterolemia, if you have these rare variants, I think clinical is your first port of call. Now, if you've got a high polygenetic risk score, you take a blood test, but don't have these variants, I'll suggest, psyllium husk, garlic, exercise, go down the lifestyle route first. And we've actually done this where we've had people with high polygenic risk, but no rare variants associated with familial hypercholesterolemia. And we've reduced their cholesterol by 25-30% just by changing their diet and enabling some exercise. So again, there's an example of don't go straight to statins, go down a different route first.
Let me ask you something that's related, but can also potentially save the NHS a lot of money, and probably why a lot of people might want to do this particular test for their genes. Weight loss. Lots of people, weight loss is very important to them. Mm-hmm. And genes, I can imagine, through evolution, some people survived because they were good at hanging on to fat. You know, they were just more efficient at keeping hold of what they ate, because, you know, food was scarce. Now, food is still scarce in some places, but generally speaking, that's not a problem anymore. Yet some people still have those genes. Can you help people like that? Or would you do the test and say, you know, sorry, pal, those are your genes. You're just going to get fat.
So this is a very interesting one. And then I think we're ticking off all the divisive kind of conversations, because I love going onto Instagram and there'd be a picture of like 1950s Britain and everyone walking down Fleet Street or something. And they're all not fat. And someone's going, look, no one's fat. Obesity is not genetic. It's all behavior, which I can understand why they've come to that conclusion, but it's wrong. So that's the best thing. So first, eating is a behavior. Now, I've got fat cells. You've probably got a few less fat cells than me looking at you. But what your fat cells do is secrete a protein called leptin. And leptin is basically telling your body, hello, you have fat cells. Now, we think in the modern age of obesity, too much food around. But actually, in the whole of human existence, minus the last sort of 60 years, we have been dealing with scarcity. So actually what it's doing, it's not telling you, you know, oh, you are full. It's actually telling your body you have enough fat reserves so you can survive. So you're absolutely right. We have this idea of actually dealing with scarcity, not starving. So this leptin molecule can bind to regions of your brain. One region is associated with suppressing appetite. So it activates the appetite suppressing neurons, and it actually deactivates the neurons that drive appetite. Now, what we've seen, actually some of the seminal works in obesity research, that there are people with mutations either in leptin itself or the receptor, which means that the person doesn't receive the signal. So you can have obese people that, you know, neurologically and hormonally think they're starving to death. And actually there's examples of these individuals where they'd go into the freezers and eat frozen fish fingers. They were eliciting the starvation response. So there's these, again, rare mutations in people. So again, we're looking at probably one in 500 people, maybe to one in 1,000 have these. But then there's a second tier of mutations that don't totally turn off these proteins, but actually like dimmer switches. So these people will have a slightly higher level of hunger. And you think about it, you know, what was it, 100, if you're eating an extra 100 calories a day, actually over the course of a year, you're looking at the best part of, you know, 5/6 of a stone of weight. Now, add that to your decade of your 30s, all of a sudden you're 3, 4, 5, 6 stone heavier, you know, and this, it's those little moments, that one snack, that extra finishing of the plate, because your appetite is suppressed less. And of course, this is one pathway, and then there's lots of other pathways associated with it. So ghrelin and neuropeptide Y that make you feel hungry. And then you've got leptin. Of course, insulin is one which makes you feel full, but we know people have insulin resistance. You can get leptin resistance. And also another one that communicates, when you've got food in your stomach that communicates to your brain to say you're full, is GLP-1. And of course, we've all heard about GLP-1 agonists at the moment. So you're creating a drug that interacts with one of the proteins that are associated with these satiety signals. And of course, what we're starting to find out, and we're doing a bit of research in the company, is actually your genetics can alter the way you respond to actually these GLP-1 agonists, so these the injections associated with the suppressing your hunger. So just to wrap it up quickly, sorry, you have eating is a behavior. There are many mutations in proteins associated with signaling molecules and neurons in your brain that regulate appetite, fullness, and also hunger. And many people get the burdens of these mutations that mean they're more likely to overeat. So you can start to understand the behaviors of why they overeat, and then you can start stigmatizes it. And two, you can start to build interventions, smaller plates, chewing, eating for longer, increased fiber, you know, all that sort of stuff. You start to think about how to mitigate that. So to summarize, yes, there is a huge component of genetics to obesity, but it's an interaction between our current environment, which is highly obesogenic, processed food, and the fact that we have genetics that have evolved when starvation was a big problem.
Yeah, goodness me. So having this sort of information that, yes, I am, you know, too fat, I am too heavy, I have some genes that kind of suggest I should, or suggest to me that I need to eat the extra biscuit or whatever it may be, does that information help them stop doing that and kind of alter their behavior along with help from, you know, someone else potentially?
So we find that it does with some people. But again, you'll fight. So I'd say like 20-30% of the people that are overweight, we've got lots of testimonials where people come back and say, it's changed my life, because again, they just change their habits. There are some people that still, I mean, we know social economic sort of conditions are really a big driver of health problems. And there are people that just don't have the time, they can't afford the food, they're doing multiple jobs where, yeah, it's lovely, they know about this sort of stuff, but in the end, they're still falling back into the habits, the types, you know. So again, if you look at the traits that sit within our weight loss category, you've got the ones we just described about hunger, associated with appetite suppressant. Some are associated with uncoupling, where your metabolism can be a little higher or lower, so you may require less calories anyway. And some are associated with emotional, so dopamine response, reward signaling, more likely to eat in stressful situations, more likely to eat when they're emotional, associated with oxytocin and the hormones around companionship and everything else. So lots of different facets. So there are different interventions you can offer them, which makes it a lot easier for people to, one, destigmatize, two, understand what they need to do, and then three, follow the interventions. But there are some people that just, even with the knowledge, will still struggle. And I think this is where the GLP-1 agonist market is really tackling that problem.
This is fascinating stuff. All of it, actually. But let me ask one last question, which in some ways might be a bit flippant. I don't mean it to be, but it stems from the name, sort of fitness genes. Do you have kind of elite athletes on the books, you know, elite footballers or what have you, and you actually somehow using this stuff enable them to be better athletes?
Yes, in short, of course, you know, but both elite athletes and we had an office in Beverly Hills for a while. I'll let you extrapolate that as well. But of course, yeah, there are people that are really interested in this stuff. Now, the one thing you'll find with elite athletes is they've probably gone through 15 to 20 years of genetic selection. So unsurprisingly, you'll see a huge enrichment in an elite athlete in the genes that happen to be associated with their skill, be it sprinting, be it long distance. Now, of course, in team sports, you get mixture of different genes. You know, people are faster, people are cognitively just sharper on the pitch. There are people that have better endurance and all that. So, and again, different parts of the team will have different skill sets associated with that. On the flip side, I think one example comes to mind is actually we had an elite Olympic level cyclist who struggled with weight gain off season. And very much what we've just described, we helped them with that. They understood it. Because again, when you're an athlete, you see this, so I used to row a little bit at Oxford, but you hang around with some of the sort of elite rowers and they eat so much. But of course, they eat so much because they're probably burning through about 6,000 calories a day. Now, of course, you go into your season when you're recovering. If your body is still telling you you need that food, it's problematic. And this cyclist was gaining weight. And again, we're probably talking about 5 or 6 pounds. But again, when it comes to the training, that could increase the risk of injury. They weren't performing at the maximum when they went back into the next ramp up for their next big I was about to say regatta, that's rowing, the sort of cycling tour
competition.
Competition. Yeah, exactly. So we've done many things. Obviously interest in getting lean for certain starring roles has been something that's been looked at in the company, but generally and we very much started off in that kind of the muscle building as well. We had a lot of bodybuilders we work with. And again, people go, it's all steroids, but it's actually no, steroids and a lot of hard work and genetics as well to get that big. But really, we've gravitated towards actually sort of public health, really get, the 30 to 40, the 50-year-olds that are no longer thinking about how do I optimize, be the best, aesthetically brilliant. It's actually, how do I live to 70, 80, 90 without all the bits falling off?
Sure, yeah.
Basically, that's really where we're starting to focus now.
Okay. Now, this whole thing is absolutely fascinating, re really interesting. If people are listening and thinking, right, I'd like to find out a little bit more, possibly even find out some more about the company Fitness Genes, what can they do?
Just
What's a good resource?
just go to fitnessgenes.com. We've got a few podcasts ourselves on YouTube. But yeah, just but just support at fitnessgenes.com. Just send us a message, ask any questions. We've got quite a small team, but we're all very we all communicate with people who are very interested in what we're doing. Again, we've got this direct to consumer business, but we've also got the practitioner business. So if you're a practitioner who thinks what we do can also help what you do and how you're trying to help people traverse their health journeys, get in touch as well. We have like a professional sort of page as well where we sort of can link in and see what we can do together.
Excellent. Look, Stuart, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. Really enjoyed it. I found it very interesting.
Cheers. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much to my guest on this week's show, and that was Stuart Grice of Fitness Genes. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.